My name is Bill Rice, and this is the first of two sessions entitled Faith, Culture, and Mission. And we will be looking at how these things, values in our culture, the faith and the tradition that we have in our faith, and the mission activities of the church interact and relate to each other. For the first session this morning, we'll look in some detail at what we mean by culture and how culture operates and how cultures change. And we'll also ask some questions about what do we think of when we think of the mission activities of the church. We may have a chance, if we have time, to look at how a specific people's culture underwent some rather radical transformations in the presence of Christian mission activity. And then tomorrow, we'll examine how the problem of faith and culture has been dealt with in biblical tradition, from early Old Testament sources on through New Testament sources. And we will look quite specifically at our own culture and see how we could take some symbols and meanings of our culture and examine what kind of transformation they might undergo in the light of the gospel. My own interest in this field began when I spent a year of my college days in Beirut, Lebanon. And it was an overwhelming culture shock. An even greater culture shock was coming back to the United States afterward and beginning, and I see you're all nodding your heads so that you know what this is, to rediscover your own culture after having been out of it for a while, and to discover some of the ironies, some of the really peculiar ways that we think of things and do things here in the light of some other experience. And then my family and I were missionaries with the United Methodist Church in Indonesia for 5 years, and much of my interest and concern in the interplay between the faith and another society stems from that experience. To begin, just to get a good precedence for a way of attacking this problem, I'm going to read from the book of Proverbs, chapter 6, verses 6 through 8. Go to the ant, O sluggard, consider her ways and be wise. Without having any chief officer or ruler, she prepares her food in summer and gathers her sustenance in harvest. How long will you lie there, O sluggard? When will you arise from your sleep? And so on. We have good precedent for examining a culture of ants. If we were to examine ants, the first thing we would notice is ant hills, piles of pebbles or of grains of sand. And we might examine them with all the diligence of an archaeologist to see how the caverns and the chambers and the rooms are formed down below. We would be interested also in examining the grains of sand themselves, see what size and shape they were, the droppings of the ants, and perhaps some of the tools that they used, chisels and hammers and bulldozers and other things. And we would find that at this level of ant culture, we had quite a bit of material to work with. So the material culture, the culture of things that people use and produce, including their technology, is the first level of culture. We wouldn't be content with that, however. We wouldn't feel that we had understood ants at all until we had observed ants doing things, watching them scurrying up and down the path, touching their antenna with each other, and apparently exchanging some information. We would discover on observation that some of the ants seemed to be doing all the work. They were running out and foraging for food, and they were coming in, and they were digging the chambers, and they were cleaning out the refuse, and other ants somewhat bigger with huge pincers, didn't seem to be doing a great deal most of the time, but if we watched long enough, we might see a war, and these ants would be fighting the war. Then there would be a group of ants that did nothing but attend to one huge ant. And so we would begin to see that the society of ants was stratified. There was a social organization. There was a caste system. And examining more closely, we could see who it was who was involved in obtaining food and in providing various services to the community. So we have got a sociology of ants, and now we have an economy, a distribution of goods and services that we could analyze. We also have a political system, for we had observed that when the ant made certain decisions, like going with her coterie to another place, that the other ants followed. And we could see that power resided within the queen ant. So, a totally, an additional level of culture then is a social, political, and economic level of culture. Sociologists might be content to stop there, but cultural anthropologists wouldn't, because they would want to know, what does all this mean to the ants? So we would scoop up our ant from the path and hold our ant in the path interview and say, okay, ant, I observe that you scurry back and forth. You are busy all day long. Tell us a little bit about yourself. And we would find out that this ant is a member of a family, a very large family. In fact, the entire hill is his family. We are all brothers and sisters, he would tell us. We all have the same mother. Okay, so you're a worker. Don't you feel that it's a little bit unfair that you have to do all the work while these other ants are just lying about doing nothing? And we would find that this ant does not feel that there's any injustice in his situation, that it is built within the orders of creation that he should be a worker. So we could learn about the values through which this society operates. We could also ask some stories. Where did you and your people come from? This ant might tell us the story of the ancient terrors under the great anteater, who used to tyrannize all of the families, until there was one great queen named Moses who led her people off onto a bit of driftwood across the great sea where the anteater could not follow. And under the guidance of the great ant in the sky, they existed for 40 days and 40 nights until they came to a new land, a land flowing with milk and honey. Well, we might hear some other story. The point is that within this third level of culture, there's a whole collection of stories and values which provide the meanings by which these ants live. They tell who we are, where we have been, how we've gotten where we are, and where we are going, what is valuable in life, what is dependable, who are our friends, and who are our enemies. Ants having enemies? Well, we would ask them about that. Who are your enemies? Not only the anteater, he'd be the ancient enemy. Now, who's comparable to the anteater today? Well, you look on down the path here, and there's another anthill, and we would see that these little brown ants would tell us that that's where the red ants live. Now, the red ants want to conquer the world. The red ants kicked the black ants out of that hill some time back, and they've been sending their spies out along the paths, and they're watching everything we do. They have more soldiers than we do, and they've come up recently with a secret weapon called DDT, a weapon capable of destroying the entire world. So these are the people we fear. Well, there are a lot of other stories that might develop. But what we can see here is that there's something enormously powerful in this set of meanings. It is this set of meanings which will determine whether that anthill puts more of its energies into supporting its soldiers, or more of its energy into foraging for food, how it will relate to its neighbors, how it will relate to to other ants within the community. Oh, I should introduce this picture of our world, which is custom drawn for us, especially by Dan Erlander. I asked him to draw us a picture of the world which would help us understand culture. So you can be looking at that and being illuminated by what we are talking about here. This third level of culture, now all of these are important, of course, but this third level, let's look at some of the dynamics of that and how that operates. For over 1,000 years, the Chinese people had the technology of rocketry. They were shooting up rockets in celebration, skyrockets, for festival days, for religious observances. The rockets were in the control of the rulers, the priests, and the kings of the people. It was a festive bit of technology. The rocket itself was a part of their material culture. For 1,000 years, it was used for festivity. Yet it's only been within about a century that the rocket has been used as an implement of war. Now, why is that? See, the rocket itself could have been used for 1,000 years as an implement of war, and it wasn't, essentially. Now, some of you historians may want to correct me on that, but that's the story I've been told. What changed happened right here in the set of meanings by which a number of societies lived by. Changes in sets of meanings which said that it is now acceptable and appropriate to use any technology within for the pursuit of warfare. That there aren't specific patterns and specific ways in which war has to be conducted, but any means is appropriate to the end of winning the war. That change in meanings made it possible to use rocketry. In the same way that we know that the windmill was invented long before anybody ever thought of using it to pump water. The water wheel, the same way. The water wheel was used to power and to run fancy clocks and things like that before anybody thought of using it to grind grain. So the meaning level of culture greatly affects the material. And of course, we also know how strongly it affects the social, political, and economic sphere, because it was changes in the meanings by which we lived as colonists that led to the American Revolution. It was a rather different understanding of the nature of man and the rights of man, meanings that were brought home to us more forcefully by the French Revolution. That set of meanings, which led to a revolution which radically changed the political organization and formed us into a country. And besides being powerful and having great effect on the material and the social, political, economic spheres of culture, the meaning level is also quite fluid, quite flexible. It isn't wrapped up in the nature of things. It is wrapped up in the nature and in the thoughts and the dynamics and the changes and the transformation of man. When I was in Beirut, a fellow student lived just down the hall in the same dorm, was undergoing a great deal of stress. Apparently, he would lock himself in his room for days at a time and not come out. And other times he would be the life of the party. He would be so full of exuberance you could hardly stand to be around him. And having taken Psychology 101, I said, oh ho, this fellow's a manic depressive. He was also my friend, but he was a manic depressive anyway. I got to talking with a psychology professor who also was counseling this student and who knew of my friendship with him, and he said, I need to share some things with you about Tao. He said, you know, Tao is demon-possessed. That he has a spirit that throws him into deep depression, and a spirit which throws him into periods of great excitement. I said, well, what are you doing about it? He says, well, we're getting in touch with the demon. And they were having sessions in which they were inviting the demon to speak through doubt. And they were becoming acquainted with this demon, talking to him. And at that point, they had already made a pact, an agreement with the demon, that the demon would do nothing that would endanger Dowd's life. For if he endangered Dowd's life, he would destroy his own home and would have to go elsewhere. And little by little, the effort of therapy was to put more and more restrictions on the demon, to fence him in to the point where the demon would decide, this is not a healthy place for me to live, I'll go elsewhere. That whole system of meanings for understanding Dowd and his therapy can be translated into what a Rogerian or some other psychologist would use as an approach to treat a manic depressive, becoming acquainted with a problem, and so on and so forth. But what struck me was that you couldn't say that this psychologist was merely using the language of demonology to talk about what was real. That is, this fellow was a manic depressive. What was real? Speaking of his problem in psychological terms was as much a function of the meaning level of my culture as speaking of his problem in terms of demonology was a function of the meaning level of his culture. In other words, the same reality, the same confused state of experience was here, but there were different ways of organizing that and making sense out of it. Now, our faith deals with exactly the same types of things that we've been talking about here, and that's obvious in the ant story. Our faith tells us who we are as a people, where we've been, where we've come, how God has created us, what He has created us for, where we are going, how we are to live, what brings satisfaction in life, how we are to live among each other as a people, where we are going, and what the future is to be. So that we see that faith is essentially the same type of thing as what we've been talking about here as the most powerful aspect of a culture. And so when a faith speaks to a culture, it is speaking not only at the point of the most important and the most essential experiences, but it is also potentially threatening them. We can, of course, dodge the conflict and say, well, there isn't really any problem at all, that faith is a matter of religion, and religion concerns itself with religious matters. We'll use our drawing here. Here's our world, our totality of our experience. And we could say that there are some concerns that our faith can deal with because faith is about religion. Well, what are our religious concerns? Doctrine, theology, worship, ecumenical relations, and in the secular world, things like prayer in the public schools, possibly something as big and as broad as the morality of abortion. And essentially we're saying that we're talking about some aspects of our total life down here. A small segment of our life which we call religious, having to do with morality and belief and the way in which those subjects get expressed in our society. Well, that's one way of dealing with our faith. And yet we know that our tradition, our biblical tradition, deals with things of a much broader scale. Another thing we can say about the meaning level of culture and about a faith is that it is comprehensive, that it has an explanation for everything, almost. Are any of you familiar with the writings or the speaking of Charles and Francis Hunter? Yes, saw a hand over here? No, okay. Well, Charles and Francis Hunter have written a number of books, and I remember very distinctly a lecture that Charles Hunter, who was a salesman, gave some time ago, in which he was explaining how God is interested and involved in the most minute detail of each individual's life, and that the man of faith then is a person who calls upon God for guidance and expects God's guidance at every point in life. He explains how he was late for a very important meeting to close a sales deal, and he prayed to God for guidance to direct his car into the right lane of the interstate so that he could get there quickly, fast enough, get there on time to close the deal to the glory of God. Another time he talks about going into a clothing store to buy a suit, and he prays to God for guidance that he will choose a suit which will be attractive, make him attractive, so that he may be more successful in his business, all to the glory of God. Within the set of meanings that Charles Hunter continued to express, one could see some principles. Anything that good that happens to me is a blessing of God, perhaps even a reward for my righteousness. Anything bad that happens to me is a testing of God, a testing of my faith, to see if I can endure it until such time as, having proven myself faithful, I shall again be blessed. Anything good that happens to a non-Christian is merely a temporary temptation, a temporary blessing, for the non-Christian will get his comeuppance. Anything evil that happens to the non-Christian is either the punishing and cajoling hand of God trying to get that person to repent, or it is a punishment for evil done. Now, within that frame of meanings, you see, everything that happens to anybody in the entire world is clearly understood and clearly has a meaning. This is a set of meanings which makes sense of every possible experience in a confusing world. Such is the power of what we are talking about. One doesn't give up a consistent and a coherent and a clear way of understanding one's life easily. We don't just throw it away, for none of us like confusion. Now I think it's time to talk about our drawing. How do you organize this? Anybody have some way of organizing our confusing world here? You see some organization there?
Turn the page over.
Turn it upside down.
Well, let's see. Oh, I see. Turn it upside down? All right. I had enough trouble getting these thumbtacks in here, so I'm not going to do it. But you can stand on your head if you'd like to look at it. Well, let's try one organization. Ours is a world of a great deal of danger, a great deal of fear, a great deal of threat. There are people out there who do not mean us well. There are people who threaten us and would seek to take what we have, who would seek to dominate us. There are nations out there who want what we have and are willing to risk anything to get it. We have to lock our doors at night because there are those who would rob us. We don't go out at night alone, or we carry a weapon, because there are those who would mug us. All right, there's an understanding of our world. Now see what that does. It makes sense. It takes the randomness of life and it puts it into a framework. Now we have a program of action. We know that we have to secure our homes. We know we have to teach our children how to protect themselves. We know we have to work towards a political program for our nation, which will protect it. And that's one way of organizing our experience. Now, just as my friend in Beirut understood his problem as demons, and I understood his problem as a psychological illness, the same experiences, the same world in which we live, the same international events can be framed in another way. We belong to a community of people which has a long history, a biblical history, that tells us about other ways, not just one, but other ways of looking at our world. We might choose to see the world like this. What do we see? A dove. Have we been sensitized enough by our whole faith that we can see the cross in our world, that we can see the dove in our world, that we can see the butterfly of resurrection in our world? Can we see the action of peace, the action of forgiveness and reconciliation within our own community here at Holden? See, this is another way of taking our world and perceiving it in a different frame. Now, I see several of you are shaking your heads. Why? Is there something wrong with our dove?
Part of the bomb.
It's part of the bomb. Also, the dove seems to be missing something, doesn't it? Okay, let's complete it. Our faith is incomplete in this world, for we are living for a hope. And hope we've been discussing the last several days, and we've been reading scriptures which remind us that hope is unseen. Hope is for the future, which is not yet here. That is, we can't prove everything. We can't prove that everything that happens in our life clearly fits the picture of our Christian hope. That we hope for a world that is not yet complete. There is a shalom. There is a future toward which we strive and toward which we build. That, incidentally, is an element of all people's meanings, but I think it's something that we must particularly stress within our Christian tradition. Now, how do these meanings actually work? How do they affect our life and our society, and what do we really mean by those meanings? We've been talking a great deal in the abstract. The meanings of a culture can be described in two basic elements, symbol and meaning. We'll use the term symbol in a very broad sense, not to mean simply something that we all know is a symbol of cross or something like that, but anything at all which serves as a vehicle for a meaning. Let's find ourselves a symbol here. There's a symbol. What's that a symbol of?
Stop sign.
Okay, we've got a red octagon on the board. The red octagon is a symbol for a stop sign. And a stop sign itself is a symbol for what?
Stop what you're doing.
Stop what you're doing, for a concept, for an idea. We're driving you stop. Or so we see that this physical line on the board is a symbol which bears a meaning. It serves as a vehicle for an idea. That idea itself, the stop sign, is a vehicle for another meaning. So that a symbol is like a truck that can be used to carry different cargo. The truck is the symbol, and what it is carrying is the meaning. What it's carrying may very well be a symbol for other meanings, and so on and so forth. But just as you can, wow, that'd be a fancy one. Just as you can change the cargo that you load onto a truck, you can change the meaning that is associated with a symbol. Let me demonstrate that. Think back to your youth, to your childhood. You were in a group of people. You girls are in a group of girls. You boys are in a group of boys. You're meeting after school in a club, and you all use this sign. What is it? Think of the club.
Girl Scouts.
Girl Scouts. Okay, I guess I should do it like this. That got confusing. Girl Scouts. Oh, you're having trouble seeing this with a... Girl Scouts, Boys, Cub Scouts, Brownies. Okay, we'll separate the fingers a little bit. And we'll go now to 1944.
Victory.
All right. 1969. You're now in 1982 in Poland. Solidarity. The very same symbol has been used for different meanings. Now, why? The symbol itself has a terrific amount of power. The symbol is something that can evoke different meanings. The meanings are flexible. They can change. Let's take another symbol. A symbol can be a concept, you see, such as freedom. Freedom is a rallying cry of our own people, one that's been used time and again. In 1776, whose freedom were we concerned with? Adult white males, but which adult white males? Very good. What was the community of people who cried freedom in 1776?
Colonists.
All right. Whose freedom was the focus of attention on January 1st, 1863?
Slaves.
We didn't even call them blacks, did we? Slaves. Whose freedom was the focus of a 40-year struggle which had a climax in 1920 with a bit of legislation?
Women.
Okay. Whose freedom was the focus of attention again in the 1960s and early 70s?
Blacks.
And whose... What people are rallying around the cry of freedom today?
Women.
Gays. People in crisis. See how this symbol has life. Symbol all by itself has life. And the direction to which that life is channeled or energized can change and does change in a culture. Changes dramatically and radically. We've seen that over a period of just a few years. I guess the question that I'd want to plant here and that we'll deal with more extensively tomorrow is how does our faith, and particularly how does our church, utilize this fact? Are we cognizant of and do we utilize the dynamics of the meaning framework within our own society? Or do we see ourselves as off here in a little bit of corner, letting society tell us that we're insignificant, that we deal with only religion? That's the big question. And we're going to drop that right now. Talk about another concept in our three-part title, and that is mission. I'm also going to take down our picture of the world for a moment. We have a little space. What words come to your mind? Let's pre-associate here a little bit. When you hear the word or the phrase Christian mission. Missionary?
Exploitation?
There was no one before that, but.
Visions?
Visions?
Service?
Service?
Sharing.
Sharing?
Blankets.
Blankets?
Quilt.
Teaching.
Medicine.
Anyways, we can go. Medicine?
Yeah, medicine.
I've missed a couple. What?
Language.
Yeah.
Example.
Hunger.
Example.
Discipleship.
Discipleship. I can't even spell it.
Fellowship.
Fellowship.
Yeah.
Food.
If you say one and I fail to write it down, just holler again so I get.
Culture.
Interference.
Evangelizing. Love.
Evangelizing.
Love.
Boy, you hit the jackpot on that one.
Calling.
Love.
Teaching.
Teaching.
Gospel.
Colonization.
Mangoes and papayas.
Disease. Just add something to the disease. I'm not sure where you're coming from.
Personal sacrifice.
All right. Okay, any other burning words that must get on our board here?
One being boiled in a pot by cannibal.
Very good.
Manual.
What?
Manuals.
Interesting. Add something to that so I know what you mean.
Stewardship.
Stewardship. Sorry.
Strategy.
Clothing.
Birth control.
Suffering.
Suffering. Gee whiz.
I'm
going to need another board.
Shalom.
Shalom. Shalom. Fantastic. What was that?
Which equality, man?
Equality.
Money.
Money.
Brotherhood.
Sisterhood. What shall we say? Siblinghood? All right. God's plan. Command. All right. I'm going to have to cut us there because we've run out of space. And you may be wondering why I've grouped all your comments into four columns. Well, the first one is generally within what we think of as evangelizing. It's unfair because a lot of things you said do not fit neatly into this scheme, and I'll say that at the outset so you don't feel as though you've been categorized in the wrong column. We need a few more columns for many of the things you said. But we can look at the activities of mission in three general categories as they relate to culture. One is evangelizing. Another is church building. And a third is service. These are intentional activities of mission. These are things that we deliberately go out and do. There is another area of unintended results or unintended effects of what we do. And I put some of your things like programs, manuals, and strategy down there because those words key on aspects of our culture which we export and may not necessarily consider as essential in the gospel, but which are related to the way we behave, in the same way as exploitation of people is generally an unintended consequence of Christian mission. We don't deliberately go out to exploit. We in turn may be exploited by other interests in our society. Now let's look at these in terms of what we've been talking about, the meaning framework of culture. Evangelizing, wonderful visions here. We have a story to tell. The story is the good news, it's the gospel. It's a story about how the world really is and who we are as a people, who we are called to become. And we tell this story. We tell of God's love for his people, of God's forgiveness for his people, of God's call for his people, of God's invitation that we all become his people. That's evangelizing. That's telling the story. That is, in terms of our picture, that is painting the dove or the cross or whatever. We go to a people and we say, this is the world as you've seen it. Let us tell you another story. Let us paint the picture in a different way. And we also invite people then to say, amen. I affirm that story. I become that people. I accept the call. I agree. I will be baptized. I will be brought into the church. And so we are about the second main activity of mission, and that is drawing people together into a community of those who share the vision, who share the faith, who say, yes, we will believe, yes, we will live our lives on the basis of that method of organizing our experience. And then the third thing we do is to say, let us then not just see the world in terms of the gospel, but we now must become the gospel. That Christ will be manifest in the world through our mission. And so we participate in all these activities, the blankets, the teaching, the medicine, the food, the love, clothing, even birth control, although that we may get exploited on that one. We see that as part of becoming the gospel, of feeding the hungry, of healing the sick, of visiting those in prison. We preach the vision of the gospel. We build a community centered around the gospel. We become the gospel. We sacrifice our being that the gospel may be manifest. All of those directly impinge upon the fundamental meanings by which a people have lived. We've told them a different story of who they are and of where they've come from, who they now belong to, and what is important in life, where they are going. And of course, in the process, there are these unintended things. How many of you have read Missioners Hawaii? Okay, I see several of your hands. But we all have heard horror stories of what happens when the missionaries go into a situation and they deliberately or otherwise, they find themselves at loggerheads with values in the culture. They tear a culture apart. So on and so forth. I'm not going to go into that in great depth, except as it bears upon this thing. But there are all these unintended consequences because mission is not merely a theoretical and theological event. It is a sociological event. It involves people going to another place and all the consequences that are contingent upon that. Okay. Yes.
At one time, though, there were many things that were unintended, which were kind of misdefined and placed over in evangelism and was assumed to be part of the vision.
You want to give us an example?
Well, I don't know. Just our Western way of living is the best way. That is part of living in a clean, wholesome environment. So let us share this with you to show you that if you can become like us, you will love Jesus more, something like that.
Okay, good point. Missionaries who did go to Hawaii said that if you are to follow Christ, you must wear clothes. That sort of thing. Not sure where that comes from the Bible, but good point. Okay, now in the, how are we doing on time? Okay, we've got a little bit longer. I'd like to tell you a little bit about a people that I have had quite a bit of contact with that underwent a terrific cultural transformation in the presence of Christian mission. And then tomorrow, we'll take some of this stuff that we've been talking about and we'll analyze how this transformation took place, where things went right, where things went wrong, where the missionaries got totally surprised by the consequences, myself included. We won't have a chance to get into those the details today, but let me just lay out kind of the background. And main reason I use these people is not only have I worked with them, but I feel that they are now, in a very real sense, my people as well, through marriage. And so I, although I'll speak of them as cannibals, I'll also speak very lovingly of them as cannibals. I haven't suffered for it yet. The cannibals were the Toba Batak people of North Sumatra, and they were well known around the world as cannibals. The Dutch East India Company had been trying to subdue them for 200 years as they had pursued their trade in the Dutch East Indies, the spice trade, and later became plantation crops such as palm oil and rubber and coffee, tea became popular. And they had subdued the Javanese and the Sundanese and the Malay coastal people and the Chinese people, and a lot of the people in the area had come under the administration and the governance of the Dutch through the Dutch East India Company, but the Batak people didn't. They were a fierce, warlike people, lived high up in the mountains in North Sumatra. There had been some attempts to subdue them, and they had the Bataks had fought them off very well. Well, at the time that this fierce people, their reputation had been spreading throughout the colonial government, both America and Europe were experiencing a wave of revivalism, end of the 18th century, early part of the 19th century, a wave of revivalism that also led to a wave of great deal of interest in mission. Now, the emphasis of mission in the 19th century, as I understand it, was primarily for the salvation of souls. Part of what it meant to be a Christian meant to evangelize, and this meant to spread the good word to the poor heathen who, having not heard the word, would be condemned to eternal damnation. And as Jonathan Edwards and others were preaching about the fires of hell, so also the concept of mission was one of rescuing, of saving souls from damnation, and through Christianization, baptism and Christianization, bringing them into the kingdom of God. With that went a lot of, with the understandings of the kingdom of God, went a lot of concepts of European society and American society. Still, the emphasis wasn't upon social transformation. Those were inconsequential, those were unintended associations with the gospel. And the gospel was primarily focused upon individuals and getting individuals to be saved. First missionaries to work with the Batak were a man named Richard Burton and Nathaniel Ward. Were sent out by the Baptist Mission Society of London, and they arrived on the port city of the west side of Sumatra, of the port city of Sibolga, around 1930. In 4 years, they managed to learn the Batak language,
They did not go up into Batak land themselves. They were dealing with informants and Bataks who came down to the coast. And they managed to translate about half the Bible into Batak script. They were followed by Munson and Lyman. I'm sorry, Burton and Ward were in the 1920s. Munson and Lyman were 1931. Munson and Lyman were sent out by the American Board of Commissioners for Foreign Missions with the express purpose of penetrating into Batak land itself and preaching the gospel there. They did penetrate Batak land, and as they were climbing up through the precipitous jungle paths, they were met by a group of Batak. The details of the story are fuzzy, but as best we can determine, they were taken to the chief, who agreed that since they were light-skinned and blue-eyed, that they were not really fully human, that they were intruding, and that they should be killed. Tradition has that they were eaten. Word of their death galvanized the church and made the evangelization of the Bataks a challenge. It also was a word of caution. So not much else happened until the 1860s. A whole generation went by when a very young fellow, unmarried, named Ludwig Nomensen from Barmen, Germany, went again to that port city of Sibolga and headed up the same trails into Batak country. We don't know a great deal about Nomensen's early experience, but we do know this: he survived. He made his home among the Batak. He was accepted by the Batak. Now think of a young man in his 20s doing this. A story is told that may give an indication of what kind of person he was. Some period of time after he had entered Batak land, there was a famine due to a drought. And the chief asked the head Datu, medicine man and medium, to call all the people together, which he did. And then the medicine man, who was a medium, went into a trance. And in his trance, the ancestors, who are very important to the Batak people, one of the great ancestors spoke through him. He spoke to all the people, saying that we ancestors have visited this drought upon you because of our displeasure with your activities. We are upset because you have let the white eyes in. And we will be able to bring the rains to you again only if you sacrifice the white eyes to us. Whereupon they called for Nomensen's sacrifice. Now imagine the scene. Nomensen steps before the entire group and proclaims to them, "The voice you have been hearing is not the voice of your great ancestor, but it is the voice of Satan, who is tempting you to violate your own customs and traditions. The great ancestors have given you a tradition which you must follow, a tradition of hospitality. And if you violate that tradition, you will indeed be in trouble with your ancestors. However, the priest is right. A sacrifice is required. And that is a sacrifice which has already been made for you in Jesus Christ." Nomensen went on to build a church and to develop a church which incorporated a great deal of the traditions of the social organization and of the daily practices of the Batak people. It's incredible to read the letters that he wrote home, because we remember that this is a period of time when the church is primarily concerned with going out there and saving souls. And let me see if I can lay my hands. Here it is. This is a portion of a letter that Nomundson wrote home in the 1860s. In spirit, I see scattered everywhere Christian congregations, schools and churches, groups of Bataks, old and young, making their way to these churches. On every side, I hear the sound of church bells calling the believers to the house of God. I see everywhere cultivated fields and gardens, green pastures and forests, tidy villages and dwellings in which are found properly dressed descendants of this people. Still more, I see preachers and teachers, natives of Sumatra, standing on the platforms and behind the pulpits, pointing out the way of the Christian life to both young and old. You will say that I am a dreamer, but I say no, I am not dreaming. My faith visions this. It shall come to pass, for all kingdoms shall be his, and every tongue shall confess that Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father. An incredible situation. A man in the midst of vicious, warlike cannibals, who has nevertheless decided to see the world, his world, the world in which he's living right then, in terms of the dove rather than the spear. And he saw it as a dove, not as something which was imposed upon the people, but that the Spirit of God would be working within and transforming the people, not only individually, but as a culture. It's even more amazing when we remember that the thrust of mission at his time was upon individual and personal salvation. And here is a man envisioning a cultural transformation. The missionaries who followed Nomundson, and Nomundson, by the time of his death in 1918, there were in the neighborhood, I believe, of 200,000 Christians. There were 30-some fully ordained native Batak preachers. There were several hundred teachers, and the Batak church very much was a revolutionary institution well within the context of ancient Batak society. We'll have a chance tomorrow to get into more detail as to what that transformed society looked like. But it is interesting to note that the missionaries who followed him didn't share Nomundson's vision at all. 100 years of mission presence, not only from the Lutherans, but from the Dutch, and from Catholic groups, from many others, 100 years of mission had an entirely different focus and thrust. Exemplified by one of the great ones, Gustav Warnock, who talked about the ineradicable weakness of racial character. His son Johannes became one of the great mission leaders, and he wrote home saying, "The assistants," meaning the native pastors and teachers, "represent the limbs, but the missionary must be the living heart which drives warm blood through all the limbs." They endured 100 years of personal salvation emphasis and 100 years of paternalism. And yet today, the Batak church bears more of the stamp of Ludwig Nomundson than it does of all these waves of missionaries who followed. And I think that's largely because of the way he perceived the transformation occurring within their midst, rather than being a set of values and beliefs imported from without and to be adopted from without. We've used up our time. Let's just take a minute or two if you have any questions that you'd like to pursue on what we've discussed today.
Well, I was wondering what type of cannibals they were. Isn't there more than one kind of cannibal?
Right. It's a little bit hard for us to know precisely, because the accounts that we have...
Yes.
You understand the problem. The accounts we have are from early explorers, and a little bit from missionaries, whose orientation, whose glasses, were such that they didn't raise some of the kinds of questions that I think you may be asking. But as best we can understand it, there is a concept among the Bataks of Sahala. Sahala is the spiritual power that a person has by virtue of certain talents that person has, but more especially by virtue of that person's relationship to you. A teacher has sahala over you, has spiritual power. A parent does, a great ancestor does by virtue of it, of his great descendants. An orator has sahala, the sahala of speaking. A great warrior from an enemy tribe who is captured has sahala by virtue of his strength in battle. And so eating, for example, the hands of that warrior brings to you some of that spiritual power. There was a practice that was, I don't know how often this occurred, but a very young child from an enemy tribe would be kidnapped and would be pampered, given everything he wanted, and made to be very subservient and very congenial towards the datu, the medicine man. The medicine man, at a certain point, this would be a month-long process, or several months process, at a certain point, the medicine man would extract a commitment from this child of complete obedience, and then immediately kill the child. The commitment made by that child's spirit was binding, and the child's spirit now, which is in the realm of all the spirits, would be subservient to that medicine man. So that these are some of the concepts associated with cannibalism. Cannibalism was not, I mean, the fundamental focus of the society. And I think what we need to see is that the concept of spirits, spirits of nature, spirits of ancestors, spirits of people, and spiritual power was a unifying vision, a unifying aspect of their understanding of the world. It is something which some of the missionaries cottoned onto and worked with, others rejected. Are we all hungry? We'll pick up here tomorrow.